I'm John Kroll. Today, on this special recorded No Limits, we're going to talk with a husband and wife writing team about their book, Summer Wind, A Soldier's Road from Indiana to Vietnam. My guests will be Randy Mills and Roxanne Mills, the husband and wife in question. Because this is a recorded program, we are not going to be able to take comments or questions by phone, via email, or through social media. But we do hope you will enjoy this conversation about a tortured and yet poignant period in America's and Indiana's history. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. This is a special pre-recorded No Limits. That means we won't be able to take calls or emails or answer questions or deal with comments via social media. We hope you enjoy the conversation. We're going to be talking with the authors of a wonderful book called Summer Wind, A Soldier's Road from Indiana to Vietnam. The authors are a husband and wife writing team, Randy Mills and Roxanne Mills. We're going to talk with them first. Welcome to the program, I should say, to both of you. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I want to talk a little bit. I'm always fascinated by the paths that lead to books, particularly with this one. And I should set this up a little bit. I enjoyed your book. I'm not sure enjoyed is the right word there, appreciated, because it is a story that has some somberness to it. But part of what I appreciated about it was that it really did take you into the life of one soldier, one family going through the Vietnam experience. And that's still relatively rare, even though, you know, the literature of Vietnam could fill entire libraries right now. The intimacy of this story was part of what made it appealing. So what I'd like to talk with you about, and I'll start. I'm not going to get into the middle of a husband and wife. I'll let whichever one of you wants to begin the conversation to talk about the path that led to this book.
Okay. We both teach at Oakland City University, and we had a student there who was going through the criminal justice program, and he was police chief in Princeton. But he came to Randy's office one day and asked him, he knew we had written before, he asked if he would write a book about his best friend that got killed in Vietnam, and really just kind of started right there.
Yeah, and it's interesting in that regard. That even though this book is about the young man that died and his family, it's also about that friendship. And as you know, after reading the book, Dick dies about a third of the way through. What's going to happen? The rest of it is
well,
about
we,
much.
Well, we know from the beginning exactly where the story is going to some degree. There's no great suspense there. It's more about how we get there and was involved. So we had to talk about the young man who is the focus of this, Dick Wolf. Could you give me a snapshot of who he was, Randy?
I think the interesting thing, and just to back up a little bit and talk about how a book gets written.
Yeah.
So we get all this material, and you start looking for themes. And the theme that really popped out to us, different aspects of it to Roxanne and then to me, was the theme of Dick Wolf having a shadow over him, being the second-born son, having an older brother who was very successful, the academic. Dick was not academic. He was somewhat restless. Didn't get good grades in school. Didn't mean he wasn't smart, but he just didn't have those kinds of interests. Made some mistakes. Which we can go into a little bit later. But I think he was an outsider, as was Butch Davis, and that's kind of what brought them together later. But Dick came out of the gates with a cloud over him would be, I think, one way of saying it. Even though he lived in a loving family and so forth, kind of archetype of the second born son really shows up, I think, in the story.
Yeah, I'm a little younger than the, you know, when the events of this were taking place. I was a child. But these were people, I grew up in Indiana as well. These are people I recognized. You know, he is a guy who the center of his life is really driving around with his buddies. He's a drag racer. He's really heavily into the car culture in a way that young people
yes.
aren't so much now. So there, you know, that portrait of him and he's a... I'll try to put this diplomatically. He's a guy you could tell, at least before he got to Vietnam, really had not put together the connection between action and consequence yet.
Yes, yes,
true.
But you bring up another or dance around another thing, and that was the culture itself. Back in the day when there was a lot of manufacturing throughout the country, and especially very heavy in Southwest Indiana. There were a lot of young men like him who, even though they weren't good in school, were going to go out in the world and make more money than professional people would mm-hmm. in those jobs. And I call them shop class boys in the book. But he came out of that. They were hardworking. They weren't necessarily best athletes or the ones the girls.
Although he was a good athlete.
Yes, yes,
he
was. Yes, he was. Even though after the tragedy of the car wreck there later. But I think that's an element, too, of there was still some traction for him within that culture. There was a lot of that there, of those kinds of young men who mainly fought the war in Vietnam because of the way the draft
Yeah, the worked. Cliche was that it was a rich man's war and a poor man's fight.
Yes.
But, you know, part of what fascinated me, too, is... You know, and we get the sense of his life largely through the letters, and I want to talk about that process. But the thing that did leap out at me is, you know, in some ways, even in the letters that you use in the book, he writes far more enthusiastically, with much greater affection, about the cars involved than he does his wife, his mother. Possible exception might be his baby sister. But,
yes, yes.
But you know, and that is clearly was a huge, huge part of his life. What made him, Roxanne, come alive? I mean, there's a point, having done some writing myself, when you're looking at something and you know, okay,
yes.
How can I tell this story? What is it about that brings this, and I'm not dismissing him because he was a real person, but this character into clear relief.
Yes. I'd say for me it was the letters, because he actually wrote quite a bit and was pretty open, you know, about what the experience was like of combat, and you could really, you know, picture what he was going through. You know, his worries about his young wife and their little boy and those kinds of things. I just got to where I liked him more and more the more that I read about him. And then plus there were also interviews, and eventually through names in the letters and other ways, we were able to contact some of the guys he was with during that combat time. And so we also got some added information about him from there, just about what a wonderful smile he had and how he would make people feel comfortable. But I'd say the letters more than anything else.
If you're just joining us, this is a recorded No Limits, which means that we're not able to take emails or calls or messages via social media. We hope you're enjoying the conversation with Randy and Roxanne Mills, the authors of the book Summer Wind, A Soldier's Road from Indiana to Vietnam. So, Randy, I'm going to ask, you know, given that there were more than, unfortunately, tragically, there were more than 50,000 people, 50,000 stories like Dick Wolf's, you know, the names on the wall, as it were. When did you look at this and decide, oh, Well, this is not just an interesting conversation I'm having with a student who happens to be one of this guy's old buddies. There's a book here.
We had a really big context to writing this particular book, and we go back to the first book that Roxanne and I had done for the Naval Institute Press about the call-up of the Marine Corps Reserve company, a Marine Corps reservist from Evansville, Indiana. And we really enjoyed and saw the value of letters and interviews and weaving that story and getting these human interest stories and including their wives and that sort of thing. So after we finished that book, I had written another book about a conscientious objector from Southern Illinois, where I grew up, who received the Medal of Honor. So another kind of a little off the beaten path kind of story. And after I finished that one, Butch shows up with his material and decided then, this is – and our first intention was to write about veterans in Princeton, Indiana, as a case study of how the Vietnam War impacted the city of Princeton. Roxanne had lost a cousin from Princeton in the Vietnam War. In the process of that, we lost a son in 2007.
I'm sorry.
And that just stopped us cold. Who wants to write a book about somebody else that lost a son? But we hung on to that material for a long time. This is in 2004. And Butch Davis was so nice about not making us feel, but he just come along, hey, you're going to finish that? You know, I understand the situation. And there came a point when we decided it was time to get that material back. And I said to Roxanne, I said, I think I'm ready to do this. The healing has taken place and there's something to be said. So there's somebody once said, if you want to understand what drives a book, see what it's dedicated to, and it's dedicated to our son. So I think some of that was just working through that kind of pain, even though that was a different kind of pain. It really torqued up that interest and made us want to finish the book. We were talking today on our way down here, and Roxanne said, I could just imagine Dick Wolf looking down and saying, can you believe it? They've written this book about me, and they're still talking about it. Because it was just one guy, and he wasn't extraordinary in any way, ordinary fellow, but he was certainly in an extraordinary circumstance.
Roxanne, was the book a therapeutic experience for you as well?
Yes, it was. Part of what we write about after Dick dies is what his family and friends and so forth do to cope with things. Things that his mom had done, I thought were, you know, things I could identify with, that I think would help anybody, you know, working through some kind of issue like that.
Were there parts of it that were hard to write, Roxanne?
I would say there were parts that made me cry every time I read them. And, you know, of course, we go through it about 20 times when you're proofreading there. But it's funny, there was one part that no matter how many times I read it would make me cry.
Which part was that?
It was when, you know, he'd kind of been through all these changes, and the last letter that he sent home and the last letters that were sent back to him, he didn't get those last letters that were sent to him.
And they were very validating.
They would yes, he would have felt so good about those.
I'm not going to go any further than that because I don't want to rob from the impact of reading the book itself, but it's a very emotional section, and all of that. I mean, I'm assuming, Randy, you found writing this therapeutic as well.
Oh, absolutely. And I think not only because of our son, but also because of the Vietnam experience. I would have been eligible for the draft. I had a draft deferment in college, and by luck, and we talk about that in the book about what an odd war that parents would work so hard to keep their kids out of there or find ways where they could at least keep them out of combat. That was just so prevalent everywhere. And I didn't think about it. But I know my parents worked very hard. And then to write about these people who did go and serve and to see what they went through, I really wanted to tell that story. That probably drove me more than anything else because I felt so fortunate to have not had to go through that. But it is interesting to hear Roxanne talk about the thing that moved her. I was going to ask what part was that, because I know I've got my part too. Yeah. We can talk about
that later. If you're just joining us, we are talking with Randy and Roxanne Mills about their book, Summer Wind, A Soldier's Road from Indiana to Vietnam. This is a recorded No Limits. That means we're not taking calls. We are not taking emails. We're not taking questions or comments via social media. But we do hope you are enjoying the conversation. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. In this special pre-recorded No Limits, we are talking with Randy Mills and Roxanne Mills, a husband and wife author team, about their book Summer Wind, A Soldier's Road from Indiana to Vietnam. Because this is a recorded program, we cannot take calls or emails or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. So I should start here. One of the things I loved, maybe because it's also one of my favorite Frank Sinatra songs, mm-hmm. is where you got the title and how you decided to use it as a storytelling device.
You mentioned that. Here it is.
Yeah.
One of the things we noticed in the letters, and we talked earlier about writing and you start looking for themes, but one of the letters that really hit me when he was writing about just how difficult it was over there and the weather and the combat and the loneliness, all of those things, and it just seemed unbearable. Out of the 6 months that he was alive during that time, I think he was only at a base for 2 or 3 days where you actually had a mat. Otherwise, he was sleeping in a hole in the ground mm-hmm. at these primitive bases. But in one of his letters, he sends this, if I may read this.
Yeah, please.
"Well, it's raining here all the time and muddy as hell. It is terrible. They are talking about a 60-day mission now. We haven't been back to our base camp in 2 months. If I had a camera now, I could really show you some pathetic pictures of all of us wet all the time and muddy as heck. We have the radio on in our tent, and the swinging 60s is on. Wow. Back in the world, they never had a radio station this good. Nothing but the latest hits and oldies but goodies, and I mean really, they really dig for the oldies. If they didn't have that station here, the morale would be really low. Larry Clay," that's a dear friend of his, Larry Clay and I just go wild over Sinatra's Summer Wind, a great song. Listen to it sometimes. When that song comes on, everybody drops what they are doing and just stands there in a daze." That was their way to get back to the world. Mm-hmm. And they're in this camp out in the middle of nowhere, literally living with mm-hmm. Holes in the ground with tarp over them. But they've got these radios, and I just imagine them filling sandbags or on a firing mission or whatever, and Summer Wind comes on, and it stops.
Well, and part of the reason I was fascinated by it, and I'd like to hear both of your thoughts on it, is, you know, it is a fascinating song. Some of it is that, you know, that one would not associate a man in his early 20s in the 60s responding to Sinatra. I mean, that's not part of the cliche either, because Sinatra at that point was in his early 50s. You know, the song... you know, is both this kind of idyllic, but there is a real undercurrent of melancholy to it, that, you know, there's this quality of fantasy. And I'm not, you know, I know my limitations. I'm not going to attempt to sing any of it here or anything like that. But, you know, it spoke also to a lot of the themes, the capriciousness of fate and all sorts of stuff that you're talking about.
Right? And it has kind of a haunting sound to it. Mm-hmm. And his younger sister pointed out something at one point, that some of the songs that he liked were sad songs, which sort of surprised her.
Yeah, Otis Redding's Dock of the Bay.
Yes, she thought of him as a little more happy-go-lucky, you know, and they had a really sweet relationship. But I think he did have that current of sadness in him, and I think, you know, like you say, there's so many things that come together in that song. There's that haunting sound. There's the thought of better times. Just a beautiful song.
And it's interesting, too, that he said everybody stops. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were all tuning into Sinatra. Mm-hmm. And I know I loved the song when it was on when I was young.
Me
you know?
Too.
Yes, it was one that you could imagine in your romantic youth of, mm-hmm. of what could be. And you knew there's going to be something melancholy about it. It was going to be great, whatever it was, that romantic sort of thing to be with someone.
Yeah. One of the things, though, that I'd like to explore, we've talked about the undercurrent of sadness for Dick Wolf. We probably ought to talk about where some of that sadness came from. I don't think we're stealing from the book unduly, because it's dealt with at the beginning, and really to understand the story that follows, you have to understand that. Roxanne, can you talk about some of the circumstances that...
Yes. He was driving a car. He really was just 15 years old, but he had a 16-year-old with him and talked him into letting him drive because, like you say, that driving culture was such a big thing. And he missed a stop sign and hit another car, and the man driving that car was killed. And it was he and his wife. They had two daughters, and it really changed his whole life because, you know, it's something that he just felt so bad about. And the principal of their high school called everybody together in a convocation and, you know, lectured him more or less in front of everybody. And he ended up quitting school, and then he finished by mail. But it was something that I think, like you say, that undercurrent of sadness really came from that, a lot of it, I would say. The other would be his brother kind of being the golden child and he being the black sheep, as he probably would have said.
And yeah. and the marriage, too. You
want yes.
to talk about that
yes.
a little bit?
Yeah.
He got married when he came home from basic training before he shipped out to Vietnam. The girl he married was very young. She was, I think, 17 when they married. And then they had the little boy that was born, you know, after he was, while he was at basic training. So he got to spend some time with them before he left for Vietnam, but not very much. And, you know, it was sort of somewhat of a forced marriage, I think, sort of hard situation for both of them. And they really didn't get any time to kind of bond together and kind of plan, you know, what they were going to do while he was gone and when he gets back. And so that was always kind of a worry for him. You see that in his letters to his mom, how he worried about that.
One of the things we struggled with there, too, was we didn't have all those letters. I think mm-hmm. some of them were probably destroyed because it was a very...
His widow
yes, yes.
Is no longer living,
correct.
So you
right.
couldn't go back to her. And get
yes,
right.
Yes. And but from the letters we wanted to be very gentle with everybody because they're young, and not take sides. But there was a lot of issues. And what was another interesting thing about that was Dick's mother was just bound to determine that he was going to come home and make that marriage work. But mm-hmm. but I think
well, she
it's
was
because,
a very devout Roman Catholic.
Yes, yes. And there
yes.
was a little grandson too, and
yes.
I think that was a big deal too. And I promised a person that I would say this if the need arose, and it has. There were two daughters of that man that was killed. And mm-hmm. their lives were drastically changed as well. And mm-hmm. I don't think there's any getting around that Dick's recklessness
yes.
led to that, even though I would argue at 15, you know, we all make mistakes. But nevertheless, it was
yes.
it was an awful thing.
And
for
I
them
would
as
say,
well.
Too, yeah. that, you know, that changed their whole lives. certainly more, you know, than it did him. And it was a really tough thing to live with. He was a very popular teacher at Fort Branch. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, tough on the community.
And not that, you know, he was only 39 when he died.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah, I mean, there is an element of tragedy there. And the, you know, the qualities of all of that had lasting repercussions. I mean, as I followed the story, he was never a stellar student. He was a promising baseball player. You know, that could have been his ticket to college and then would have been his ticket out of going over there if he hadn't run that stop sign. And all of that. And that's one of the things I think that that is intriguing about the story you tell, because there is a tendency with stuff like this to kind of idealize the experience. And, you know, he led a messy life.
Yes.
In that way, it's a lot like, you know, my life or your life or anyone else's. I haven't run into or killed anyone in a car, but there are things that we all have that we regret, and all of that. So, you know, once you got into this, I mean, how did Butch Davis, who was his friend and was really the instigator, I think, for driving this project forward, how did he know that you were going to have this treasure trove of letters and all of that? Because the book wouldn't have been possible if the letters hadn't been preserved, right?
Right, right. Butch knew the family and had stayed in contact with them. And he found a few letters, and he knew there was many, many, many more out there. And they went to Dick's mother, Joe, the older brother, Wolf and Butch, and tried to see if she still had them, knew where they were. And she was very old, and I think mentally not completely there anymore, and just worn out. I think she was in her 90s at the time. And she said she didn't know, and that looked like it was going to be the end of things. But they looked under the bed, and they found them in the box. It's becomes a very important, maybe the pivotal part of the story, that Butch and Dick came together as good friends, both outsiders, both experiencing depression and a feeling of not belonging, and together they made a whole. Ooh. One had what the other one didn't, and that friendship was stronger than most in that regard. And before they left for Vietnam, after they were drafted and they knew where they were going to go over there at the same time, they made a promise that they would come back, they would survive, they would live, and they would grow old and tell war stories to their grandchildren. And I think there was kind of a lot of magical thinking in Vietnam when you were over there and before you went, that if you did these kinds of things, had the right kind of totem, a lucky piece or something, or made a promise of some sort, that would magically bring you back. And I think that was going on, and that helped them until life intervened in a different sort of way.
Well, and death.
Yes.
And death. Roxanne, you know, Randy says that they completed each other. In what ways?
Well, why don't you answer that one? Because
okay.
I
became very close to Butch Davis and him helping me.
Yeah.
And by the way, he did not live to see the book come out.
No.
He died in September before it came out in November. He did get to read a draft of it.
Thank goodness.
Yes, yeah. That was good. I think where Butch was very moody and could have rage issues, Dick was very happy-go-lucky. So you had that kind of thing working. Butch was careful. Dick was impulsive. Butch wanted to be a drag racer. He didn't know how to break into that drag racing community. He just wasn't a part of that group. And when they got together, Dick got him in that. So they were kind of a drag racing team. If you remember, there's one story in there. If you love drag racing back in the olden days when you had these muscle cars and you go on a back road, there's a really great story that Butch tells that we have in there about Dick telling him when to shift the car, you know, because it didn't look
like...
And he
didn't listen well enough.
Yeah, didn't listen well enough. And he lost. And then Dick, being the friend that he was, you know, kind of made fun of him in a good way, in the way that friends can. But I think they completed themselves in what one lacked the other one had.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with authors, husband and wife author team, Randy and Roxanne Mills, about their book, Summer Wind, A Soldier's Road from Indiana to Vietnam. This is a recorded No Limits. That means we're not taking calls, emails, or messages via social media. But we do hope you're enjoying the discussion. So, you know, we've talked about who Dick was. The other part of the book that I found really, really valuable, and I've read a lot of Vietnam stories in my time, including some that you cite. In fact, even interviewed Tobias Wolff at one point about his book. Yeah. But is that it really took us inside that world of what it was like to be a soldier in Vietnam, and added, because often we look at that experience in isolation, and it's not like Dick's life back here in Indiana stopped just because he got transported over there, that a lot of the challenges and issues he had, the, you know, difficulties continued. Roxanne, could you talk a little bit about you know, the tensions in the marriage and all of that?
Yes. Money was a big worry. You know, he was very worried about being able to take care of his family when he got back. And so he sent money home. He didn't use hardly any of it. But he worried about, you know, how that money was being spent or taken care of. So that was something that showed up a lot in the letters. You know, like I say, they didn't really get a chance to spend much time together. And, he worried about her riding around in town and, you know, seeing other guys. And, in fact, was very disturbed because there was a period of time where she didn't write to him. And that was really tough. And he found out she had written a letter to his friend, Butch.
Davis.
Yes, who felt awful, you know, once he told Dick that, because he hadn't realized that Sue hadn't been writing to Dick. So there were some tough things with that. And one of them, Dick's sergeant, is a character that comes alive quite a bit in the book. And, you know, he was aware of that and sent her a letter explaining why, you know, she needed to either tell him it was over or write to him and send him pictures, you know, of her and her little boy. So he was somebody I really grew to like over the course of reading about him and hearing his answers in his interviews. But those kinds of tensions, I think, were the main things as far as the marriage goes.
Is that one of the big regrets, writing the book, that because there is a certain, you know, wistfulness or whatever, you know, we don't hear Sue's voice that much.
Yes.
In this, that she wasn't there for you to interview and track down.
Yes, and we, you know, we wanted to be sure that everybody got a fair shake on that, you know, so we did try to find people who were friends of Sue's. And, you know, that was a very difficult thing, as young as she was, to go through. And again, they didn't know each other, you know, in the way sometimes people do when they've been together for a long time. So that was, you know, something we tried as much as we could, but there was a limit of what we could find.
And we will pick that up on the other side. If you're just joining us, we are talking with husband and wife author team, Randy and Roxanne Mills, about their book, Summer Wind, A Soldier's Road from Indiana to Vietnam. Because this is a recorded conversation, we're not able to take questions or comments by phone, by email, or by social media, but we do hope that you are enjoying the conversation. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please Stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. In this special recorded No Limits, we are talking with the husband-wife author team, Randy Mills and Roxanne Mills, about their book, Summer Wind, A Soldier's Road from Indiana to Vietnam. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take calls or comments, questions or comments, via phone, email, or social media. But we do hope you're enjoying this conversation about the book. So before we went to the break, I asked about regrets about Sue's voice, basically, Dick Wolf's widow, who eventually remarried, obviously. When did she die?
She died, I think, in the 1970s, maybe. She had breast cancer.
Oh, boy.
And then the
so she did not have a long life at all.
No, no. And maybe a little longer than that.
Yeah, I think it was
a little longer than that. But the little boy died.
Very quickly.
Yeah. When
that was very,
he had leukemia. So that was very sad. In fact, the Wolf family's all gone, but the sister, Carolyn, who was very helpful, by the way, in all this and very supportive. And Joe's still alive, but he has some kind of Alzheimer's
or dementia.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Sue did have other kids after she remarried.
Okay. So was that, Randy, I gave Roxanne a chance to answer the question. Was that a primary regret, or were there other regrets, people you weren't able to talk to flesh this story out? Because I know, having done this stuff, there are always people you cannot get to, and you think, oh, gosh, I wish I could have seen that point of view.
Interesting question in the modern age of internet and being able to find anything on Google. It would have been very disappointing not to have been able to find people that Dick was with and served with and were in the battle where he was killed and endured the things he endured up to the time of the battle. So all these names were in his letters. And some of them were as simple as Larry Clay. And I would Google and find addresses and names, and there'd be little clues on where they might be, and I'd start narrowing it down, and then I would find an email or call. I actually got a hold of Larry Clay, who wanted to talk about everything but the death of Dick Wolf. So we talked about – oddly enough, he was born in the same hospital I was in, in Mount Vernon, Illinois. But anyway, those kinds of odd things. But we found – everyone, every name in there we found, and we got extra letters and interviews, which really, really helped us to fill out all of that.
Even journals.
Yes, and even journals and diaries. So there would have been a great regret because you always know those people are out there. But I felt like we were able to turn over every stone. What we never figured out was the mystery of his death. And that's something that, and I don't want to give away too much about that.
Yeah, there are, you know, and I lost track after a while. It's like there are four different accounts of how he died.
Yeah, actually six official document, or like on the telegrams and what they wrote after the battle, six different wounds that supposedly killed him, and plus the eyewitness accounts. So then you've got four and five of what happened.
Yeah, no, it's and that part is fascinating because it does give you a sense of just how chaotic something you know, like that must be, and therefore how terrifying for the people involved.
I would say this too. Now we're back to how writing is autobiographical, but that really, really bothered Butch to the day he died. Yeah. Even as we started finding new clues, and I would tell him, not knowing exactly how his friend's life ended, in the family as well, and having lost a family member, a son, I know exactly what that's like now. You want to know everything you possibly can, even if it's difficult kinds of things, because it's all you have. It's that last part of their life.
How did you divide up the writing responsibilities? He's turning and looking at you, Roxanne, so I guess we'll start with you.
We've done it different ways for different books. The one we had written together before, we really kind of separated out chapters on that one. But this one, it was a little more integrated. And, you know, we would both look at it and think, you know, what do we need? Who do we need to find out something from? And then if we would interview by phone or whatever, we would, you know, take notes and write up the part for that. Like he said, most of the combat things, you know, he did most of the writing on that. I would say it was about two-thirds, one-third on this book as well as our other one, with his part being the two-thirds.
I think it was interesting with Roxanne, with what she would do with the mother's letters and concerns, and with Sue. She would bring out and point out things that I wouldn't catch about the tension that might have been there. But also, she would point out in these letters there was intimacy there as they would write. I mean, they were young. They had been very physically intimate and had enjoyed that part of things. And now he's 10,000 miles away. So how they would try to touch that in the letters. But also, Roxanne mentioned this in one of the letters, was just really 2 pages of very mundane information. And Roxanne made the comment, she says, we need to tease out the fact that this is exactly what he wants to hear, day to day, what's going on. Her washing her hair, doing the ironing, singing to their son, those kinds of things that I would have missed that she picked up on and was able to kind of tease out in the book.
And one of the phrases that he and Butch used that stuck with me was back in the world.
Yeah.
You know, back home was being back in the world.
That they were stuck in a, you know, a place far, far away.
Yes.
That, so, and I want to stick actually for a moment with your relationship here. When and what was the moment when you decided, oh, we ought to try to write a book together? I know this was not your first. Take me back to, because there are a lot of spouses who would say, oh, no, we're not going to go there.
I think you can start with our first book and finding those pictures.
Yes.
I
mean, the first book kind of came out of the house that we bought, you know, basically to raise our kids in. And the lady who sold it to us was very elderly and was really happy there was a family that was going to be there, because she had had 4 kids and we had 4 kids. And so we found a picture up in sort of the attic area there of some young men at a train depot in uniform. And we're just, you know, really curious, you know, well, who are these people? Who were these people to the people that lived in the house? And eventually we found out that one of the young men had been the son of the lady we bought the house from, had gotten killed in Korea. And his best friend, in a sense, sort of like Butch and Dick, he always wanted, you know, the story told about him. He felt guilt, because he had encouraged him to join the Marine Corps Reserve Unit. But back to how this brought us to writing the book, we were both, you know, just very, very interested in that story. And in tracking down people, we found this whole huge group out of Evansville who had just started getting together and meeting about, oh, maybe 8 years before that, who were kind of ready to tell their story. And we just both, you know, really wanted to do that.
The synergy there is that we realized that with combat soldiers, when they hit about the 50s, 60s, they need catharsis. They're ready to tell their stories. We didn't know that. We learned that in writing Unexpected Journey about the Marine Corps Reserve Company out of Evansville. And so we were primed to do this next book. Mm-hmm. When you stop and think about it, we had all the ingredients. We'd done it before, and we really enjoyed. I remember when they had the 50th anniversary in Evansville of that reserve company, and it kind of made national news. Mm-hmm. That Marine Corps Reserve story was unusual. And I remember standing there as they were playing the bagpipes, Amazing Grace, and Roxanne saying, you know, this, it's never going to be better than this. If we ever write anything again, it will never be feel like this, because this is the first time it was really, really a blessed thing to do. And this was, too. I would say this would
yes.
tie it.
Yes, I would, too.
Especially after the loss of our son. I think there was kind of a new element of learning. You learn when you write. Mm-hmm. You learn that the unbearable has to be born and it can be done.
Roxanne.
The other thing is what in these kinds of stories that it means so much to the people that experience them, to their families, that's by far the most rewarding part of it, that for them, you know, it just means a lot that story's been told. Dick's younger sister has, of course, been a huge supporter all along, and most of the book talks we've done and so forth, she has been there. But we did one at their home church in Princeton, and we had no idea he had so many cousins and different people in the family, but people just expressed appreciation for telling his story. And I think that really drove us on both books.
Yeah, and that's a story that was forgotten. It was gone if it hadn't been for Butch Davis wanting it resurrected. But I guess we were prepared when he came. It was just all set up to happen, that kind of synergy where, and the responses from the wives is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
One emailed and said, "I feel like I've been with my husband now. Mm-hmm. I understand so much better. We can talk about it now. I know how to approach him." And so there's just a lot of healing that comes with that. And that Vietnam business was our generation's our thing. We carry it. All of us carry it, whether we're over there or not. So it just feels good to be able to do something about it, to try to fix what can be fixed and all of that, I think.
If you're just joining us, we are talking in this special recorded No Limits with the husband and wife author team, Randy and Roxanne Mills, about their book Summer Wind, A Soldier's Road from Indiana to Vietnam. Because this is a recorded program, we're not taking calls, emails, messages via social media, Facebook or Twitter. But we hope you're enjoying the conversation. So what parts of writing the book did you find the most satisfying? Roxanne, I'll start with you.
Well, I think some of it is finding those themes in the letters and, you know, looking at, you start seeing the shape of an individual story. What were the tensions? What were the things that were important? What were the things that were difficult? That initially, I think, is the best part. And then once you start finding all these other people to tell the story and to add to it, it just kind of got richer.
I think from a creative point of view, it was writing that battle. That was two chapters.
Mm-hmm.
To take a chaotic event that nobody understands, can begin to understand the big picture, and to get all these parts, many of them inconsistent. We had letters 2 and 3 days after the battle. We had interviews that were taken after the battle. We had official reports. Then we got interviews of people's memories 50 years later. We had an audio tape. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
I think that may be the only audio tape of the war out there like that. There was a fellow from that company before they went out and got caught in that surprise attack. It was Dick Wolf's lieutenant of his platoon. The commander got mad at him and sent him back to the main base. When that battle started, that guy put a tape in the tape deck, and so we have an audio of that. So that was a piece of it, too. But putting that all together and working it and trying to make sense out of it was a real joy. And it also called for a different kind of writing, because there's a lot of action there, and if you notice, the sentences get a lot shorter, and you want to move it, and there's more dialogue. All of those are literary devices that...
Yeah, you want to go with a more staccato voice
at
that point to capture the sort of percussive nature of the violence and all of that.
That's something he did really well in our first book, too. There was one chapter where there was so many things going on with the different parts of this group and everything, and I remember he just had to get his mind cleared for a while to, you know, shape that all into one writing of it.
So what do you hope that people will take away from this book? Randy, I'll start with you.
when I did the one on Vietnam about the Medal of Honor recipient that was a conscientious objector, there was a fellow there who'd lost his legs in Vietnam at my talk. And he was a member of Veterans for Peace now, Vietnam veteran. And he asked me that very question, and I felt, okay, I need to get this right. But I will repeat that because I think it's still true, that we should never, ever send our precious resources of our sons and daughters into war unless we absolutely have to. And when we have to, absolutely have to, we should always, always, always honor them when they come back.
Roxanne.
I think that the healing that, you know, you feel like you have some small part in that happens for people, for me, that's probably the most satisfying thing is knowing that that's made a difference for some people.
What was the feedback? Obviously, Dick's younger sister, Carolyn, zero.
The zero.
Is still alive and sort of aware of this. What was her response when she read it?
You want to tell about the funeral? Because that's interesting where, you know, wasn't allowed to.
Yeah, we've got 2 minutes.
Okay. Just
about a minute and a half, actually. Sorry.
Just real quickly, that was very difficult for her when Dick died because she was very young and she was sent away for a couple weeks. Didn't really feel like she was able to participate in mourning for him. And it didn't hit her till she was much older, and there was a movie about Vietnam called Coming Home that she saw. And I think
John Voight and Jane Fonda and Bruce Dern. Great movie.
Yes, it is. And I think for her, this was another chance to, you know, go through that process of grief. And I think feel very proud of her brother, too. So,
how about the other guys who served with him, Randy? What's their response been like?
You know, Dick Wolf, because of the unusual circumstance of his death, everybody remembers him from that battle. And it stayed with them. So when I would contact these people, they were just glad and amazed and really wanted to talk about it because it had stayed with them for 50 years. And by telling their stories and putting it together in a whole, they have been, I think, very grateful and very, it's just been very wonderful to be able to help tell their story too and to let them be able to grieve about what happened to them too. It was just a horrendous battle. So that's been a blessing as well, I think, to do that for them.
And that will have to be the last word. I really appreciate Randy Mills and Roxanne Mills talking with me today about their book, Summer Wind, A Soldier's Road from Indiana to Vietnam. Also like to thank our listeners for joining us. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator Scott McAllister. Technical producers Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.